Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome, welcome. So glad to see you all, to be seen by those of you watching online. And as we jump into kind of the last part of this series, our teaching series called Born, I just want to say thank you to those of you who have already given to our Give, Serve, Love campaign. Many of you have already done this. A lot of you are sitting there going, oh, that's today. Yes, that's today. And you're going to wait till tonight before you go to bed. That's perfectly fine, perfectly fine. But today is kind of the last day for this. We're going to reveal that number at our Christmas Eve services. But this has become a Christmas tradition for us as a church. Over the last 15 years or so, always a special season because we take the opportunity to love our community and our world out loud. We are not asking you guys to give to the church, we're actually asking you to give through the church, to people, to organizations that we'll never see, we'll never meet, we'll never be around, and I think that is worthy of jumping in and being involved, and your generosity is going to allow us to write some big old checks to those people, and we love doing that. So again, I want to say thank you to those of you who have or will participate in this year's Give, Serve, Love campaign. Can't wait to see what God does through our collective giving. But today, part four of this series called Born, I want to start with a little bit of trivia, okay? And some of you are like, all right, let's go. Others of you are still trying to wake up. That's perfectly fine. So you participate however you want to participate. The category is Disney movie songs. Okay? Yeah, let them come. Just let them flow. Let them flow, right? The question is, what are the most popular Disney movie songs of all time? Okay, so some of you, you've got them, you're rattle them off, take a minute. I'm going to give you the top five most popular Disney movie songs of all time, according to Billboard magazine, okay? So, here we go, the fifth most popular Disney song, Colors of the Wind. Yeah, I need to confess, I don't remember this one. I don't, and I'm sure somebody out there, like, this is your favorite song and I just offended you, I'm sorry. I still don't remember it. Okay? That's number five. Number four, Let It Go. I definitely know this one. Definitely. My daughter was all about this one when she was younger, and we still haven't let it go. So, that's number four. Okay, number three, A Whole New World. Now we're talking. This is from my era of growing up. This is from the 90s. I could sing every word to this song, but as my mom used to tell me, just because you can doesn't mean you should. So I'm not going to. It's a whole new world, okay? Number two, another one from my era. Can you feel, see, I shouldn't sing. Can you feel the love tonight, right? From Lion King, another one I could sing. But the number one most popular Disney song of all time, according to Billboard magazine, we don't talk about Bruno? Yeah, that was my response too. I was like, really? That does not make any sense. It's shocked me, but I'll tell you who it didn't shock. Any of you who had young kids in 2022 when this movie came out. Any of you who have people who are really, really big fans of Lin-Manuel Miranda, he's the one who wrote this. This is from the movie Encanto. Maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't. It's about the Madrigal family who have an Uncle Bruno, and as you can tell by the name of the song, we don't talk about Uncle Bruno. It's a major plot line in the movie, so I'm not going to ruin it for those of you who haven't seen it, but there's this family secret in the Madrigal family that's shameful, it's embarrassing, they don't talk about it, right? So this family, this Madrigal family, my guess is they're not the only family with family secrets, right? Like, they may be the only one who came up with a song and dance routine about a family secret, but my guess is there's some families represented here today that there's some stuff in your family you don't talk about. There's an uncle you don't talk about. There's this embarrassing thing that happened maybe around Christmas at some point that you don't talk about. We don't talk about this. There's something, there's somebody, there's skeletons in the closet. Now, we're not going to talk about this week when we get together, right? The interesting thing is, we're not talking about your family Christmas, you know, your family tree this Christmas. We're not talking about mine. We're talking about Jesus's family tree. And it's really, really fascinating to dig into his family genealogy and notice all of the skeletons in the closet. All of these Uncle Brunos that are in Jesus's family tree. It's surprising because you would think that the holy, pure, unique Son of God would come from the greatest family ever. And then you read Matthew 1. You read his genealogy, and the family had some skeletons in the closet. There's some Brunos in Jesus' family tree. We looked at one of them a couple weeks ago, but as a reminder, here's how Matthew starts his gospel account. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of the first Bruno, Judah, right? We talked about him. And his brothers, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Now, here's where it gets really, really interesting and unusual. Because Matthew includes a mom. He includes a woman. The rhythm is so-and-so is the father of so-and-so, who's the father of so-and-so, who's father, you know, on and on and on and on. And then he throws in whose mother is Tamar. To include a woman, to include a mother in the genealogy of somebody this important was unheard of in the ancient world. It was absolutely unheard of. It was a patriarchal dominated society. Everything was tracked through the father. But Matthew, the tax collector, he includes a woman. He includes not just one woman. He includes five of them. Why? Okay, why would he do this? We're going to put on our historian hats today a little bit. We're going to put on our genealogy hats a little bit today. But as we've already seen, Matthew's point in starting his gospel this way is to prove to his Jewish audience that Jesus is, in fact, their Jewish Messiah. And so that's why he mainly connects Jesus to Abraham and David. But his inclusion of these five women tells us the kind of Messiah Jesus will be. Matthew is doing this on purpose. Matthew is telling us who Jesus comes from, but he's also telling us who Jesus comes for. And Matthew is going to give us a glimpse into the heart of God as revealed in Jesus. And it makes perfect sense when you remember Matthew was one of Jesus' original 12 disciples. Like, he spent 3 years with Jesus, saw up close and personal how he interacted with people, all kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of situations. And these five women that Matthew chooses to highlight, like, every single one of them has an incredible story. Like, we could do a five-week series on these five women. But what I really want you to see today, what I want you to feel today, and I'm going to do my best, I want you to see and I want you to feel how Jesus engages with people who shouldn't be there. How he sees them, how he responds to them, and what that tells us about the heart of God. We've already looked at one. We already looked at Tamar. We're not going to cover her story again today, but I want you to learn from the others. What do we learn about Jesus from these stories? What do we learn about ourselves in relation to Jesus, and why does that even matter? So again, like last week, we're going to weave in and out of lots of stories today, but the first thing we just need to settle in on, we've already said it, but we need to settle in on this. Matthew's inclusion of women in the genealogy was unusual for first century standards. But here's why I think he did it. Matthew included women in the genealogy because Jesus included women in his ministry. And again, I think he's making a very, very huge point. He's attempting to accurately represent the kind of Messiah Jesus is from the very beginning. So let me show you what I mean. Luke, the doctor who thoroughly investigated the events that he wrote about, right? He tells us, he gives us a perfect example of how Jesus included women. After this, Luke tells us, Jesus traveled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. I don't know how many too many demons is, but 7 demons seems like a lot. Joanna, the wife of Chusa, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. If you've not seen it yet, The Chosen does a great job of kind of bringing this out and showing how much women were involved in Jesus' ministry. But Jesus said, I mean, Luke tells us right here, the 12 disciples are there, kind of the inner circle that we know about. But along with the 12, he gives us specific names of women right alongside the 12 who are just as involved in the ministry. He actually tells us they're funding the ministry out of their own means. We see Jesus including, valuing, and even elevating women at a period and a time in culture where that didn't happen. We don't know of any other Jewish rabbi who invited women to be a part of the group. We have no evidence from anywhere else, from anybody else from that period of time that does this. It really appears like Jesus is the only one that would be called rabbi, who included women, valued women, elevated women in this way. And it isn't interesting that there's a narrative in our culture, in Western culture, it's alive and well, that Christianity is anti-women. That the very patriarchal, where women are second-class citizens, some of you grew up in kind of religious settings where that was a message that was taught, that was spoke about and hinted at. You might even be here, and you feel like there's some truth to that. I would encourage you to read the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and watch how Jesus treats women. Over and over, I'm gonna share a couple stories just today. You never see Jesus treat women as less than, ever. It's actually quite the opposite. He honors them. He dignifies them. He values them. He elevates women in a time and a culture that really didn't. In fact, there have been numerous scholars that have connected how that Jesus kind of unleashed this slow revolution of women's rights, that we can trace women's rights today in Western society all the way back to Jesus and the early church. Before Jesus and the early church, like in every culture, women were property. But then Jesus unleashes this revolution that took a really long time. But because of Jesus and the early church, we see this today. And listen, I get, like, Tim, this is not a Christmas message. Okay, I get it. Some of you struggle with this idea. Some of you have really big feelings on this topic. I'd invite you to spend some time with this resource, Jesus Through the Eyes of Women by Rebecca McLaughlin. You might not be able to see the subtitle there, but How the First Female Disciples Help Us Know and Love the Lord. One of the most thorough resources on the subject. I'd recommend it highly to anyone. We'd say a lot more about that, but if you want to take a deeper dive, read that book. It's gonna take it so much deeper than we can right now. But back to the big idea. Matthew includes women in the genealogy because Jesus included women in his ministry. The thing is, Matthew could have included a lot of women, right? Because for every dude, there had to be a dudette to bring about the next generation, right? And you would think he's trying to create this idea that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. So Matthew, surely you're going to pick some of the big famous matriarchs of the Jewish faith, like Sarah, Abraham's wife, or Rebecca, Isaac's wife. That's not who he chooses. That's not who he chooses. Some of the women he chooses aren't even Jewish. If the whole point is to prove Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, why include Rahab the Canaanite? Why include Ruth the Moabite? Matthew, like, what are you doing? That hurts your argument. But again, Matthew is revealing another facet, another layer of the kind of Messiah Jesus is. When Matthew includes non-Jewish women, he's pointing back to this promise that God made Abraham. That Abraham, I'm going to bless you, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. He's pointing back to this promise that God gives Abraham through your family line, Abraham, I'm going to bless the whole world. So Matthew, he includes non-Jewish women in his genealogy to show his Jewish audience that Jesus wasn't just the Jewish Messiah. He's actually the Messiah for the whole world. He's the Messiah for everyone. And we see this play out in the life of Jesus. I want to look at one specific example. Happens in the region of Samaria, the kind of the middle ground in the land of Israel. The capital city, Jerusalem, is to the south. Galilee is to the north. This is where Jesus spends the majority of his time. And right smack dab in the middle is Samaria. What you need to know about Samaria is, if you were Jewish, you didn't like Samaria. You didn't go to Samaria. You hated Samaritans. They were half-breeds. In fact, if you wanted to travel from northern Israel to southern Israel or vice versa, you did everything you could to go around Samaria. You're not going to go through, you're going to go around. Not Jesus. In John chapter 4, Jesus intentionally chooses to go through Samaria to a specific well, to a specific woman. You should read this story this week if you've never read it. It's found John 4. It just illustrates the kind of Messiah Jesus is. It illustrates the kind of Messiah who has a heart for outsiders, for people on the outside looking in. He's at this well with this Samaritan woman. He asks her for a drink of water, and she's shocked by this. Like, why are you talking to me? There's about 20 reasons you shouldn't be talking to me right now, much less asking me for a drink of water. Here's what Jesus responds. If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. This is a springboard for Jesus to go on to explain to her who he is. He reveals to her that he is, in fact, the Messiah, the one they've been waiting for. And you go, okay, cool, Tim, what's the point? The point is, this is the first time in John's gospel that Jesus reveals he's the Messiah. And who does he do it to? A Samaritan woman. That's on purpose, ladies and gentlemen. He does this on purpose. She's an outsider by all accounts. So Jesus is revealing his heart for the outsider. And I wonder if we have any outsiders in the room today. Don't raise your hand. I wonder if we have any outsiders. Like, you're here, or maybe you're watching online, and we sing these songs, and you're like, I've never heard those songs in my life. I say John, and you're like, I don't know where that is. Have no idea what you're talking about. I don't even know how to find it. You feel like an outsider. And yet, there's something pulling at your heart, drawing you to the person of Jesus. Can I just say, number one, you're welcome here. Even if you feel like an outsider, I don't know how you ended up here, but can I just say, Jesus pursues outsiders. He pursues people who don't know the language, who don't know the songs, who don't know where to find the passage in the Bible. He wants a relationship with you because his heart is inclined towards you. He's leaning in towards you, and he wants to bring you into his family. If you feel like an outsider, Jesus is for you. What about those of us who are insiders? Can I talk about myself for a little bit? I'm an insider, born and raised in the church. What are we supposed to do with this idea that Jesus' heart is for the outsider. Well, if you grew up in church, you know all the songs, you've been following Jesus for years, I think it's important to remember that Matthew wrote his gospel to insiders. Matthew writes to a Jewish audience. His whole point is to show that Jesus was their Jewish Messiah. And yet, from the very beginning, in a genealogy, he includes non-Jewish women. It's just like right out of the gate, he's challenging the insiders to remember God is for the outsider. Jesus is not just our Messiah. He wants to be their Messiah too. He's actually kind of challenging their worldview a little bit. So here's a question to chew on, to wrestle with. It's actually a question we're going to come back to in the new year and put some meat on the bones. Here's the question. Is there room in your life for outsiders? Is there room in your life for people who are on the outside looking in? Because I'm not that different. I know I get a microphone, and I know I stand in front of a room, but I'm comfortable with my circle of friends. I'm comfortable with my family. I'm comfortable with my routine. I'm comfortable sitting on the row with people that I know, right? We're comfortable with all those things. And if there's no room to be interrupted, if there's no room to kind of have outsiders come in, are we really reflecting the heart of Jesus? Are we honestly reflecting the kind of Messiah Jesus is to them and to us? He went through Samaria intentionally. He chose to do it. He intentionally talked with this woman. He intentionally revealed who he was. Is there room in our life for outsiders? Are you reflecting? Are you revealing the heart of God to people kind of outside your comfort zone? I think we just need to recognize. In the ancient world, to be a woman puts you on the outside looking in on multiple levels, but to be a non-Jewish outsider, that puts you in a very vulnerable place. Which brings us to another gal who makes the list. Her name is Ruth. She actually has an entire book of the Bible named for her. It's called The Book of Ruth. Again, I encourage you to read John 4. Just go ahead and add the book of Ruth to the list. It's an incredible story, and I am going to attempt to summarize it very quickly, and it's going to be a very poor summarization, okay? Ruth is from Moab. She's not from Israel, but she marries an Israelite, and everything goes wrong from that point on. It's similar to the story of Tamar. All the men die. Ruth's father-in-law, her husband, her brother-in-law, they all die. And in the ancient world, this puts her in a very vulnerable position because there's no government support. There's no social security. There's no life insurance or pension. There's no church benevolence funds that she can go to. She was dependent on the men in her life to provide for her. So Ruth, serious trouble. Serious trouble. But God's heart is for the vulnerable. And God ends up providing for Ruth through a very obscure law that God had given his people. The law was essentially, if you become a widow, a man from your husband's family steps in to marry you, to provide for you, and to care for you. That sounds so absolutely nuts to our Western modern ears. But that was God's way of providing for vulnerable women. So a guy by the name of Boaz becomes what's known as Ruth's kinsman redeemer. He steps in, he marries her, he loves her, he provides for her, and we find out, this is amazing, we find out through the genealogy, Ruth is King David's great-grandma. In a very powerful way, very realistic way, God redeems Ruth's story. And Matthew includes her in the story to show us the kind of Messiah Jesus is, to show us the kind of heart that God has for vulnerable people. And we see this again over and over in Jesus. He engages with people in very vulnerable places. One story from Luke's gospel, again, a woman in a very vulnerable place. She's been bleeding for 12 years. Just awful, 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 awful. And the physical side of that was bad enough. But according to Jewish law, that made her unclean. She's unclean, which means she has to separate from society, separate from her family. She couldn't be around people without making them unclean. So it's 12 years of this condition, but she's also alone. And on top of that, we're told that she's spent all of her money to try and find a cure, and nothing's worked. So she's bleeding, she's alone, and she's broke. That's a vulnerable place to be for anybody. But she hears about this Jesus, this rabbi who can apparently heal people, and he's coming to her town. And a crowd gathers around Jesus. She sneaks as close as she can to Jesus as she reaches out to touch his cloak. And she's doing this because she believes if she just touches him, that she'll be healed. And when somebody touches him, Jesus stops and says, "Somebody touched me." And the disciples do exactly what you would expect the disciples to do. They're like, "Oh, there's lots of people touching you, Jesus. There's lots of people all around you. What do you mean somebody touched you?" Here's what Jesus says. "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Jesus felt something. He felt something go out from him, and I just kind of envisioned the whole crowd stopping and going, "Was it you? It wasn't me. I don't know. It wasn't me, right?" And this woman, already been through so much, can't hide. She comes clean about everything. She tells Jesus the whole story, not because she was caught, not because she was embarrassed. She tells him the whole story because when she touched Jesus, she was healed. The moment she touched him, she felt the bleeding stop. And I just want you to see, and I want you to feel, as best as you can, Jesus' response to her. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Keep in mind, this is an unauthorized miracle. She stole his power, right? This is unauthorized. But Jesus responds to her, "Daughter," like it's relational. "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Her value, he values her. He points to her faith and just demonstrates so vividly God's heart for vulnerable people. And I don't know who needs to hear that today. And I don't know why. You're in a vulnerable place emotionally or physically. You're in a vulnerable place financially, maybe even relationally. You're scared, you're worried, you're wounded. I just want you to know God moves towards you in those times. God moves towards vulnerable people because of the cross. Because of what Jesus accomplished on the cross, we have the privilege of calling God Father. And in turn, he calls us daughter or son. God's heart is for vulnerable people. He moves towards you. So can I encourage you, move towards him? Like, move towards him. Be like this woman. Find where Jesus is and go there. Grab hold of him. He's the safest, gentlest, strongest person you could ever hold on. Move towards him because he's moved towards you in this moment, in that place of vulnerability. One last thing. I think Matthew includes these women in this genealogy for. I think it demonstrates God's heart to redeem, God's heart to bring hope and peace and joy to desperately broken, hopeless situations. Rahab is included in the genealogy. She's a pagan prostitute living in the city of Jericho. And Israel's about to conquer the city, so they send spies to kind of scope out the whole thing. And Rahab decides to leave Team Jericho and join Team Israel. She decides she's heard about the God of Israel, how powerful he is, so she switches sides. And through this series of events, we're told that she's actually enfolded into the people of God, that Israel kind of accepts her as their own. And she makes the list. She makes the genealogy. You have Bathsheba involved in an affair with King David. I don't know that she had much ability to say no to the king when he invited her to his palace, but she ends up pregnant. Matthew, he doesn't even call her by name. Read it. It doesn't say Bathsheba, it says Uriah's wife. Uriah was her husband, whom King David decides to position on the front lines of the war, in all effects, essentially murdering him to cover up the whole thing. Matthew's Jewish audience would have cringed when they read that. Why? Because it brings up a stain in King David's history. We don't talk about Uriah's wife. And yet, here it is, right there. And you look at those two situations. You read the stories. And I admit, we don't necessarily feel the emotion that Bathsheba felt whenever she found out she was pregnant. We don't feel the emotion of what she felt whenever she heard that her husband died. We have no idea the stress that Rahab dealt with when she decided to switch sides and help the enemy. We don't understand all of that, but we do understand, many of us, what it's like to get woken up by a call in the middle of the night, right? We know what it's like to be thrust into situations we didn't ask for. We know what it's like to get news we don't want to hear, much less deal with. It's in those moments. It seems hopeless. It seems so messed up. It seems so broken. Where God does some of his best work. It's wild to think that those women who dealt with those things, who experienced those things, they're like the great, 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 however many great grandmothers of Jesus. Matthew goes out of his way to include them, to make sure their stories are right in front of us. Why? Why does he do it? I think it's because he wants us to know what kind of Messiah Jesus is. He wants us to know God's heart as lived out through Jesus and in Jesus to redeem, to bring about hope in absolutely hopeless situations. Again, you see it in the person of Jesus. He lived this out. I'll give you one example that comes to mind. We read about it in John's gospel. Religious leaders constantly trying to trap Jesus. They want to find a way, a rationale to silence him. So they come up with a plan. They find a couple who's caught in the act of adultery, and they only bring the woman to Jesus. Interesting part of the story. They only bring the woman before Jesus, but they bring her before Jesus in public. So there's lots of people around. They drag this poor woman in front of this crowd and Jesus, and they say to him, "In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Our understanding is that she should die, Jesus. What do you say?" Again, they don't care about this woman. They don't care about the law. They're trying to trap Jesus. And why do they think this particular tactic will work? Well, because they've watched Jesus. They've watched how much compassion he has for people. They watched him and heard him talk about the law. And they're thinking, okay, if he doesn't follow the law here, we got him. If he ignores the law in front of all these people, they'll see him as a fraud. But if he says, okay, stoner, all that supposed compassion he's shown up to this point goes right down the drain. So what does Jesus do? How is he going to respond to this? He does something so interesting. He stoops down and he just starts writing in the dirt. I think he stooped down because it was a sign of humility. I think he was identifying with the woman who was caught. He gets low. I think it's also to kind of calm everybody's nerves. Because he just stays there for a little bit, writing in the dirt. You guys a little uncomfortable right now? You're like, "Tim, there's no dirt down there. That's carpet." And what he wrote in the ground has been an endless source of speculation for centuries. John doesn't tell us, unfortunately. Some people think he was just drawing in the dirt to waste time. Some people think he wrote the passage in the law that condemned the woman and the man caught in adultery. Some think he wrote out a passage like Exodus 23:1 where that talks about unrighteous witnesses. Some people think Jesus wrote the names of the men accusing her. My theory is that he wrote down the sins of the men who've dragged this woman in front of him. And the reason I think that is because of what he says when he stands up, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Essentially, okay, guys, if you want to do this, let's do it to the letter of the law. Whoever saw her commit the act and accuses her of breaking the law, you first. You start the stoning. And he stoops back down and he starts writing in the dirt again. I just love it. But slowly, one by one, and we're told from the oldest to the youngest, the accusers leave. Again, I don't know why, but the older you have, the more sin is on your list. And it's just Jesus and this woman left. And again, I want you to see, but I want you to feel how Jesus responds to her. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Notice, he calls her to something greater. He calls her to redemption, to leave your life of sin, but he does it so gently. He does it so kindly. He does it so shrewdly, right? And I just want you to picture something here with me, okay? I want you to imagine yourself standing in the place of that woman. You're absolutely guilty of breaking God's law. You should be punished. You should pay for what you've done. The truth is, every single one of us, 100% guilty, and we stand condemned. We deserve the punishment for breaking God's law. That is the truth. But Jesus willingly went to the cross. He suffered. He died the death we deserve. So you and I, like that woman, can hear those same words from him. "Neither do I condemn you." Jesus was condemned in our place. He took our punishment so God could say to you and I, "Neither do I condemn you. Now go. Leave your life of sin." God's heart is to redeem every story. He does it with Rahab. He does it with Bathsheba. He does it with Ruth. He does it with Tamar. Jesus did that in the story with this woman caught in adultery. Jesus wants to redeem your story too, because God's heart is to redeem. His heart is to redeem, which means today is an opportunity, maybe for the first time, for you to hear those words personally. Just going to put them up on the screen again. And I want you to imagine these words being told directly to you. "Neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin." Today's an opportunity for you to trust that Jesus says that to you. He says it to you. You have the opportunity for your life to go in a completely different direction. Didn't we hear a story about that earlier? There's grace at the cross. There's power at the cross. It's available to anyone and everyone who would believe Jesus is who he says he is. And Matthew makes sure we know this. He makes sure. He does it in a kind of a surprising, creative way. It's almost like these little Easter eggs hidden in the genealogy. By including these women, he wants us to know the kind of Messiah Jesus is. He wants us to know that God's heart is for women in a culture that was not for women. His heart is for outsiders and vulnerable people. His heart is all about redemption. Matthew had a front row seat to all of that. And he wanted us to see God's heart displayed not just in the life of Jesus, but in the genealogy, the family line of Jesus from the very beginning of his gospel. And as we close, you may have noticed I left out the fifth woman in the genealogy. I said at the very beginning there are five women, and we've only talked about four. Who's the fifth? The very end, we read, "And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who was called the Messiah." The fifth woman is Mary, the mother of Jesus. And there's something in all of the women's stories, all four of them, that you kind of see mirrored in Mary's story. There's heartache, there's heartbreak, there's brokenness, there's vulnerability, there's all these things. And these four women's stories that you see in Mary's story. And Wednesday, we're going to come back and we're going to gather together for Christmas Eve to celebrate the birth of Jesus. And when we do that, we'll talk a little bit about Mary's story. So if you want to hear Mary's story, you got to come back Wednesday. And I hope you're able to join us as we celebrate Christmas together. But in the meantime, I hope you understand, I hope you see, and I hope you feel God's heart for you as displayed in Jesus. What he's done, what he's promised to do, and what he continues to do even to this day. He is worthy of everything. Would you stand with me? I would love to pray for you as we move into this Christmas week. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. Thank you for giving us somebody like Matthew to show us, to help us, this eyewitness to your life and to your ministry. And then God, just the creativity that he uses to point back to your heart for the kind of people who usually kind of feel like they're on the outside looking in, who people who are in a vulnerable spot in life, in relationship, in money, wherever it is, you move towards them. And then God, for showing us through these people who really lived, these real people from a distant time and a distant culture that saw your redemption story at work in their own story. And you actually used their story to bring about your Messiah, your redeeming character, your redeeming activity in this world. Father, would you, in only the way that you can, speak to each and every one of us right where we're at. Would you send us out as people who make room in our own lives, in our church, in our families, wherever we find ourselves, for the outsider, for the vulnerable, and for those who have still yet to experience your redemption in their life. God, would you help us with this? Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for Christmas. We love you. And we ask all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thanks for being here. Have a wonderful week.